Mrs. Ganess snapped, then took her companion by the arm and led him from the bank. Later that same day, Tuesday, January 14th, Belle sent Ray Lamphere off on an errand. She had arranged a horse trade with a cousin of hers, she explained. John Moe was his name. Lamphere was to meet him in Michigan City, where the transaction would take place. If, for some reason, Moe failed to show up that evening, Lamphere was to spend the night there and await her cousin's arrival the next morning. At around 5 that evening, Lamphere set out for Michigan City, about 12 miles away from LaPorte. He brought along a friend for company, a brewery wagon driver named John Rye. There was no sign of Moe at the livery barn where the swap was supposed to take place, so Lamphere and his pal killed a few hours, first at an oyster house, then at a 5-cent vaudeville show. At around 8, after checking again at the livery barn, Lamphere, in defiance of his employer's express orders, told Rye that he was heading back to LaPorte. They caught the 8:15 interurban car, pulling into LaPorte about an hour later. Saying that he wanted to see what the old lady was up to, Lamphere promised to meet Rye later at Smith's Saloon, then strode off in the dark toward the Ganess farm. Rye waited at the bar for an hour, but Lamphere never showed up. As for Andrew Helgelein, no one ever saw him alive again. 9. Endgame. In preparing for his trip to LaPorte, Helgelein had ignored some of the suggestions so lovingly proffered by his dearest best friend in the whole wide world. He had not, for example, withdrawn all his cash from the local bank and brought it with him sewn inside his underwear. In other regards, however, he had gone along with her proposals. Evidently, he agreed with her that it was best to tell no one about their relationship, that his plan to start a new life with Belle should remain a delicious secret between the two of them. As a result, before setting off for Indiana on January 2nd, he had said nothing to his brother, Asala, about his destination, only that he would be back home in a week, surely. When 10 days passed with no sign of his brother, Asala grew concerned. Thinking that Andrew might have gone to see a family friend named Minnie Cohn in Minneapolis, Asala sent her a letter. She confirmed that Andrew had paid her a visit, but said that he stayed only about 1 hour. "I am surprised to hear that Andrew is not home," she wrote. John Holth, the farmman Andrew had hired to look after his livestock, had also begun to wonder about his employer's absence. Looking around Andrew's cabin for a clue to his whereabouts, he came upon dozens of letters, which he promptly turned over to Asala. All were signed Bella Ganess. Precisely what happened between Belle and Ray Lamphere on February 3, 1908, is unclear. Some newspaper accounts claim that she fired him, others that he quit following a dispute over some unpaid wages. It is certain, however, that a bitter break occurred between them on that date. So abrupt was Ray's departure from the farm that he left his clothes and carpenter's tools behind. Less than a week later, she hired a replacement, Joseph Maxson, who took up residence in the second-floor bedroom reserved for Belle's hired hands. In the meantime, Lamphere had consulted a local attorney, who counseled him to return to the farm, demand his money and belongings, and, if refused, inform Mrs. Ganess that he was prepared to file a replevin suit, an action to recover unlawfully taken personal property. Lamphere did as advised. Far from being cowed by his threat, however, Belle not only drove him from her property, but immediately wrote several letters to the county sheriff, Albert Smutzer, complaining that she was being harassed by her former handyman. The following month, after spotting Lamphere skulking around her farm, she had him arrested for trespassing. Tried on March 13th before Justice of the Peace S.E. Grover, Lamphere, with no legal representation, pleaded guilty and was fined $1 plus costs. In mid-March, after writing to the LaPorte postmaster and confirming that Mrs. Ganess was a resident of the city, Asala Helgelein sent Belle a letter. She responded on March 27th. "You wish to know where your brother keeps himself," she wrote. "Well, this is just what I would like to know, but it almost seems impossible for me to give a definite answer." According to her highly dubious account, Andrew had left home to search for another of his brothers, a professional gambler who had absconded from Aberdeen in January. After failing to find him in Minneapolis, Andrew had briefly stopped off in LaPorte before continuing on his quests. He was going to make a thorough search for him in Chicago and New York, she wrote. He always thought that he, the brother, had gone to Norway, and he would go after him. Belle claimed that after arriving in Chicago, Andrew sent her a letter saying that he was to look for his brother the next day, and he said I shouldn't write until I again heard from him. Since then I have neither heard or seen anything of him. Now this is all I can say to you about the matter, she said in closing. I have waited every day to hear something of him. On March 28th, one day after writing her letter to Asla Helgelein, Belle filed an affidavit alleging that Ray Lamphere was insane. According to the document, a printed questionnaire on which her responses were recorded by hand, she noticed the first signs of insanity in Lamphere in December 1907 when he told me things that I knew were not true and unreasonable. Asked if he had shown any extraordinary propensities of feeling or conduct, she replied with an emphatic, yes. He comes to my house every night, at all times of night, and looks in the windows, commits misdemeanors. Though he had already been found guilty and fined for this harassing behavior, he continues same, generally while intoxicated. Presented with a checklist of behavioral traits that best described Lamphere, Belle indicated that he was silent, melancholy, restless, seclusive, dull, profane, filthy, intemperate, sleepless, and criminal. Appended to Belle's affidavit was a statement from Ray's physician, Dr. Beau Bowell, who testified that he had prescribed for Lamphere at different times during past 5 years, have never treated him for any mental disturbance. I do not consider him insane. The 3-member Insanity Commission appointed to examine Lamphere and rule on Belle's allegation came to the same conclusion. We find patient, quiet, clean, and neat, they wrote. He is slightly nervous. His memory is good for recent and remote events. Speech is intelligent and coherent. Ray Lamphere is not insane. Thwarted in her effort to have Lamphere declared insane, Belle had him arrested again for trespassing in early April. His trial was set for the 15th. Shortly before it took place, Asla Helgelein wrote to her again, asking to see the letter she had referred to in their previous exchange, the one ostensibly sent to her by Andrew from Chicago. Belle replied that she was unable to do so because the letter had been stolen by a man named Lamphere, who worked for me for a while. This Lamphere began to find so many wrong things to talk about until at last they arrested him, and they had 3 doctors examine him and see if he was sane. They found him not crazy enough to put in a hospital, but perfectly sane he is not. He is now out under bonds and is going to have a trial next week. But one thing I am sure of is that in one way or another, he has taken the letter from Andrew he had sent me. Others have told me that Lamphere was jealous of Andrew, and for that reason troubled me this way. To represent him at his 2nd trial, Lamphere retained the services of local attorney Wirt Warden, who requested a change of venue to the nearby town of Stillwell. The proceedings took place as scheduled on Wednesday, April 15th, Justice Robert C. Kincaid presiding. During his cross-examination of Belle, Warden, seeking to undercut her credibility, launched into an increasingly combative interrogation of her past. "Peter Gunness, your husband, died very suddenly, didn't he?" he inquired. Instantly, the state's attorney, Ralph N. Smith, was on his feet. "Objection! He carried considerable life insurance, didn't he? Objection! You collected that life insurance, didn't you?" Smith, growing angrier by the moment, told the witness that she did not need to reply. "Mrs. Gunness," said Warden, "how did that sausage grinder and crock of hot brine come to drop on Mr. Gunness's head anyway?" Springing to his feet, Smith, his face flushed with indignation, protested in strong language against the practice of browbeating a witness and insulting a defenseless woman. Undeterred, Warden proceeded to question Belle about the sudden death of her 1st husband, Mads Sorensen, how he happened to die, whether he had any life insurance, and whether she got the life insurance. Smith's heated objection to each of these questions was sustained by Justice Kincaid. When Warden then pressed Bell about the suspicious circumstances of Matz's death, wasn't there some talk about taking up his body to see if he had been poisoned? Smith gave full vent to his outrage. "I object to these questions," he cried. "They have nothing to do with this case. I demand that they be stopped." Then, turning to the witness stand, he said, "Mrs. Ganesh, you would be justified in waylaying this man on his way home." Justice Kincaid concurred. "I think these questions have gone a little too far," he told Warden. Warden, seemingly chastened, indicated that he was ready to dismiss the witness. As Bell was getting to her feet, however, he said, "Oh, just a moment. When will your daughter, Jenny Olson, return, Mrs. Ganesh?" This question brought a sharp response from Justice Kincaid, who rebuked Warden for wasting the court's time by asking such questions. By the time she left the stand, Bell, who had been perfectly composed at the start of Warden's interrogation, was visibly agitated. To Kincaid, there was nothing surprising about her reaction. It was that of any decent woman resenting such insinuations. Soon enough, he would arrive at a very different conclusion. That Warden's pointed questions had been deeply unsettling to Mrs. Ganesh, reinforcing her fear, already aroused by Asala Helgeline's inquiries into her brother's whereabouts, that her crimes were catching up with her. Lamphere was found guilty and ordered to pay a fine of $5 plus costs, a total of $19.01, which was covered by his current employer, a farmer named John Wheatbrook. But Bell wasn't done with her former farmhand and lover. Less than a week later, she had him arrested again for trespassing. He was lodged in the county jail when Bell received another anxious letter from Asala Helgeline. In Bell's reply, dated April 24th, she expressed her wonder as to where Andrew keeps himself. Promising to tell you all I know, she repeated her earlier story, adding a few minor details. "I cannot remember the accurate date he left La Porte, but it was either the 15th or 16th of January," she began. "My little daughter took him to the streetcar station. He went by way of Michigan City as he had a desire to see that little town about 12 miles from La Porte. He didn't stay there more than a day, and he left here at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. 2 or 3 days afterwards, I had a letter from him from Chicago saying that he had hunted for his brother but did not find him. If he couldn't find him, he would go to New York and find out if he had gone to Norway. If such was the case, I think he would go to Norway too. As I said before, he told me not to answer his letter until I had one from him, telling where he would stop for a little while so he could get an answer. This is all I can tell, and I haven't his letter. I got the letter in the morning and read it and laid it in the china closet in the kitchen and went to milk, and when I came back, the letter was gone. That Lamphere was here, and he had probably taken it. I don't understand what keeps Andrew away so long, unless, as you say, he has gotten into some trouble and does not want any of us to know about it. I, for my part, thought it was strange I didn't hear from him, but I was pretty sure Lamphere had taken his letter. But I don't see why he hasn't written to you." Responding to Asala's proposal that he come to La Porte and initiate a search for his brother, Bell assured him that she would be happy to assist him in any way she could, though I don't know what we could do to find him. The day after Bell composed this letter, Ray Lamphere was brought once more to trial. On the witness stand, both Bell and her 11-year-old daughter Myrtle claimed that Lamphere was back to his prowling. Just a few days earlier, they had spotted him by the pig pen and hurried out to chase him away. They were within 15 feet of him when he coolly cut the wire fence, pulled out the fence post, and carried it away. This time, however, Ray's defense lawyer, Wirt Warden, was able to call a pair of witnesses, two substantial citizens of the county, who swore that, on the day his client was allegedly vandalizing her property, Lamphere was at the home of John Wheatbrook, about 6 miles out of town, and could not possibly have been at the home of Mrs. Ganesh. Lamphere was acquitted, leaving Bell to foot the bill for the costs. Miss Bertha Schultz, a clerk in the Chicago Leader dry goods store on Main Street, who frequently waited on Mrs. Ganesh, later reported that, during the last week in April, Bell had come in looking very distressed. When Miss Schultz asked what was the matter, Bell recounted her troubles with Lamphere, describing the things which he did to harass her, and declaring that he acted as if he knew something about her and that he was bold and annoyed her repeatedly. The next day she was back in the store, once again giving vent to her worries over Lamphere. "She told me that she feared he would someday set fire to her home and buildings," Miss Schultz would say afterward, "and that he would murder her and her children." 10. Monday, April 27th, 1908. Joseph Maxson, Ray Lamphere's replacement, would later testify that Belle had kept her daughters home from school that day. Their teacher at the Quaker school, however, Miss Carrie Garwood, told a different story. As Miss Garwood recounted, "On the morning of April 27th, I noticed that the two little girls of Miss Ganess came into the schoolroom crying. Their cheeks were swollen from weeping, and they seemed in great distress. I called Myrtle to me and asked if she was in trouble. She replied that she and her sister had been given a terrible beating by their mother that morning. It was the first time I had ever seen the children behaving so, and I was surprised. I pursued the questioning, and Myrtle told me that she and her sister had started in play toward the cellar of the Ganess house. Mrs. Ganess rushed after them before they reached the bottom of the stairway, and, dragging them back, had given them both a terrible beating. 'You keep out of there,' she told the oldest girl. 'Don't you poke your faces where they are not wanted.' I asked the children if they had been forbidden to go down into the cellar, and they said they had, but they had forgotten the injunction." Later that day, Belle hitched up her buggy and drove into town. Her first stop was the office of her lawyer, Melvin E. Leadlighter. Tearfully, she informed him that she was living in fear of Ray Lamphere, who was threatening to burn the house down over my ears. Leadlighter advised that the simplest way to deal with Lamphere was to fill him full of buckshot the next time he showed up at her farm uninvited. Dismissing the suggestion, Belle told the lawyer that she wished to make out her last will and testament. She wanted to leave everything in good shape, in case something happened. Leadlighter proceeded to write out the document according to Belle's instructions. She left all her property, both real and personal, to her three children, Myrtle Adolphine Sorensen, Lucy Bergliot Sorensen, and Philip Alexander Ganess, providing that in the case of the death of any of said children without issue before her death, the survivor is to inherit the whole of the property, and provided also that in the case of the death of all three of said children without issue, the whole of the property should go to the Norwegian Children's Home of Chicago. Once her will was completed and signed, Belle took it to the state bank, where she placed it in a safe deposit box, and made a cash deposit of $730. Her next errand was at a store where she purchased candy, cake, and a toy train, telling the clerk, Marie Farnheim, that she was going to give the children a little treat. "Is it a birthday party?" asked Miss Farnheim. "No," said Belle. "I am just going to give them a little surprise." Belle's trip to town that afternoon ended at John Minich's general store where, as Clerk George Ways recalled, she purchased a large quantity of groceries. She bought something else, too. 2 gallons of kerosene and a 5-gallon can that she borrowed from the proprietor, explaining that she had searched for her own oil can before leaving home, but had been unable to find it. She had been in the store about 15 minutes when Ray Lamphere entered and asked for a 5-cent plug of chewing tobacco. According to Ways, no words passed between Lamphere and Mrs. Ganess, not even a nod of recognition. Lamphere just stood by the counter and glared at her while she finished up her shopping. He then followed her outside and watched as she untied her horse from the hitching post and drove off in her buggy. Belle arrived home at about 5:30 p.m. Joe Maxson helped her with her purchases, carrying the oil can into the house and stowing it in the entry under the back stairs. An hour later, he and the family sat down to a supper of bread and butter, dried beef, salmon, beefsteak, and potatoes. "Everyone showed a fine appetite," Maxson said later. "We all had a couple of helpings of beefsteak and lots of cookies and jam." When the meal was done and the dishes cleared from the table, the five of them, Maxson, Belle, Lucy, Myrtle, and Philip, repaired to the parlor and played all kinds of games, the main one being Little Red Riding Hood and the Fox. According to Maxon's recollections, Mrs. Ganesh loved to play this game and almost cried if the bad fox chanced to catch Red Riding Hood. By 8:30, Maxon was having trouble staying awake. Bidding the others good night, he headed for the stairway. "The last I saw of Mrs. Ganesh," he recalled, "she was sitting on the floor with her daughters and son, playing with the toy engine and passenger coaches she had bought earlier that day for the children." Part 2. The Murder Farm. 11. Conflagration. Mrs. Ganesh was already up and cooking breakfast. That was Maxon's first thought as he surfaced from his sleep. From the smell of it, though, the hotcakes were burning. Suddenly, he was fully awake, choking and coughing. His room was filled with smoke. Leaping from his bed in his long johns, he threw open the window and stuck his head outside. The house was ablaze. He yanked on his boots and started kicking and pounding the door that separated his room from the main part of the house, where Mrs. Ganesh and her children slept. He tried yelling fire, but the smoke was so dense that he could hardly breathe. Pulling on his overalls, he grabbed a small satchel and a handful of belongings, then raced down the rear stairs and made for the carriage shed about 50 feet away, where he left his stuff before running back to the burning house. He tried reaching his room again, but got only as far as the second floor landing before the flames drove him back outside. After trying to kick in the front door, he grabbed an axe from the tool shed and chopped out a panel. All at once there was a great crackling sound overhead. Looking up, he saw the flaming roof collapse into the bedroom where, just a few minutes earlier, he had lain sound asleep. Not far away, Mrs. Ella Clifford arose as usual at around 4 a.m. to prepare breakfast for her husband Michael, who went off to work before daybreak. Looking out the kitchen window, she saw her neighbor's house ablaze. She called to her teenage son William, rousing him from sleep. Within minutes, he was on his bicycle and pedaling furiously to the Ganesh place in order to wake the people, if there was any chance, as he later testified. He arrived just as Joe Maxon was taking his axe to the front door. Running to his side, the teenager peered through the broken-in panel. All he could see was fire. By then, Mrs. Clifford had alerted both her husband, Michael, and her brother-in-law, William Humphrey. They arrived at the Ganesh place to find Joe Maxon standing helplessly by the front door, axe in hand. "Where do they sleep?" said Humphrey, yelling to be heard over the roar of the flames. Maxon pointed to the two upstairs windows on the west side of the house. Searching around, Humphrey found some bricks and flung one at each of the windows. The glass shattered, flames spurted out, but no one responded from inside. "Is there a ladder around here?" Humphrey shouted to Maxon, who immediately made for the woodshed. He returned a moment later, dragging a ladder. With Michael Clifford and his son supporting it on either side, Humphrey scaled the rungs and peered through one broken window. There was an empty bed in one corner of the room. "No bodies, just a mattress on the bed. No body or sheets," Humphrey said afterward. Fire was coming through the floor. Hurrying down, he and the Cliffords moved the ladder to the second window. Again, Humphrey climbed to the top, peered inside the other room, and saw nothing but an empty bed. He thought of going into the room, he testified, but as the flames were coming through the floor, I was afraid to risk going in. Humphrey sent Michael Clifford to alert Daniel Hudson, who lived with his family a short distance away. Roused from bed by Clifford's insistent pounding, "I thought someone was going to break the door in," he commented afterward. Hudson, still dressed in his nightshirt, groggily asked what was wrong. "Are you going to let your neighbors all burn up while you sleep?" cried Clifford, jabbing a finger toward the Ganesh place. Looking in that direction, Hudson saw a constant blaze from every window. Everything was alight with fire. As Clifford hurried back to the burning house, Hudson threw on his clothes. "I didn't even stop to tie my shoes," he related, "and went over there as fast as I could, half-dressed. I got over there and everything was alight with fire. The only place that I saw that wasn't burning was the southwest corner. The wind blowed right hard against that. The east side was ready to drop, and the whole thing was a solid blaze." Hudson saw at once that there was nothing he and the others could do. "You better notify Sheriff Smutzer," he said to Maxon, who immediately ran to the barn and led out one of the four stabled horses. "The horse was afraid," Hudson remembered, "but between the three of us we got him hitched to the buggy, and Mr. Maxon started for LaPorte, the horse going at a good jump." The courthouse clock read 5 o'clock when Joe Maxon reached the jail. Manning the desk was Deputy Sheriff William Antis, who, after hearing Maxon's story, accompanied him to Sheriff Smutzer's house a few blocks away. Despite the six-shooter he wore cowboy style on his hip, there was something almost dandyish about Albert F. Smutzer. His best-known newspaper photograph shows a round-faced fellow with a large, neatly trimmed mustache and an incongruously snazzy outfit. Knitted turtleneck sweater beneath a nicely tailored wool jacket with a peaked leather cap riding jauntily on his head. He liked to travel in style, too. In stark contrast to his neighbor's horse-drawn modes of transportation, he tooled around town in a snappy red Ford runabout. With Antis in the passenger seat, Smutzer drove his automobile out to the Ganesse place, while Maxon followed in the buggy. By the time they arrived at the home, only parts of three walls were still standing. "There was nothing to do but watch until the flames died down," one chronicler records. Smutzer summoned the members of the volunteer fire company who went to work throwing water by the pailful over the glowing embers and pulling down the tottering fragments of brick wall. By then, at least 50 spectators had gathered at the scene, a number that would soon grow into the hundreds. Among them was Harry Burr Darling, editor of the Argus Bulletin, one of LaPorte's two dailies. That afternoon, his newspaper carried the first of what would quickly become a nationwide deluge of sensationalistic page-one stories that would not subside for months. "The House of Mystery has become a house of horror," his article began in fine melodramatic style. "Several years ago, this house was associated with a mystery. Today, it is a funeral pyre. The tragedy of the husband and father, whose mysterious taking out of the world proved a mystery on which little light was ever thrown, was followed this morning by a holocaust in which the wife and children were tortured to death by flames. The fire raged for an hour until nothing remained but three brick walls, which stand as grim evidence of the devastating work of the holocaust." Though the blaze had burned itself out by daybreak, the heat from the smoldering ruins kept Smutzer and the others at a distance. Setting up a bucket brigade to carry water from nearby Clear Lake, volunteers doused the rubble until it was cool enough to approach. By the cellar door, the men perceived signs of a blaze so concentrated that it must have been man-made, the work of an arsonist, or incendiary in the terminology of the time. Among the crowd of rubberneckers, a rumor spread that Mrs. Ganesse herself, suffering from a weakened mentality over her recent troubles, had started the fire, that, as Darling reported, her despondency caused her to plan and execute the harrowing tragedy. Sheriff Smutzer and others, however, who knew the details of her ugly feud with Ray Lamphere, believed otherwise. As Darling informed his readers, the officers were firmly convinced that the former hired hand had set fire to the house through a motive of revenge. Smutzer immediately assigned his two deputies to track down the suspect. At the time the Argus Bulletin went to press that afternoon, however, Ray Lamphere's whereabouts remained unknown. "No trace has been found of the man upon whom suspicion rests," Darling wrote. "He has disappeared." In the meantime, another hunt was about to commence. Arming themselves with picks and shovels, a dozen men, Smutzer among them, made ready to dig through the ruins of the fire-ravaged house in search of any sign of its missing residents. "Evidence," wrote Darling, "of the four lives which were snuffed out." 12. Discovery. About 2 miles away from the Ganesse farm, beside the tracks of the Lakeshore Railroad, stood the Interlaken School, a progressive institution founded by one of LaPorte's most eminent citizens, Dr. Edward A. Rumely. Opened in September 1907 with an enrollment of 13 male students between the ages of 9 and 18, its purpose, as Dr. Rumely explained to an interviewer, was to produce young men of initiative, courage, and self-reliance, men who will dare to do great things, who will not bow before precedent, and who will have the power to become fit leaders of men in this great industrial republic. Among the first students to attend the school was Carter Hugh Manny, who, fulfilling Dr. Rumley's ambitions, would go on to have a distinguished career as a businessman, civics leader, and supporter of the arts. At around 4 o'clock on the morning of April 28, 1908, so he recalls in an unpublished memoir, Manny, then just a few months shy of his 17th birthday, was awakened by a schoolmate, Tubby Washburn, who occupied a room with a window that faced north, the exact direction of the Ganesse place. Washburn had come to tell me that there was a big farm fire a couple of miles away. A few moments later, Dr. Rumley himself made the rounds of the bedrooms, telling us to stay up and watch if we wished, but please not to leave the school grounds. While Rumley went off to use the school telephone to see what he could learn, Manny accompanied Washburn to his room, where they pulled up chairs before the big open window and watched the conflagration. The fire was obviously a fair-sized farmhouse, Manny observed, because it burned for nearly 2 hours. Had it been a barn, the fire would have consumed it rather quickly. When daylight came, Rumley informed the boys that the fire had consumed the home of the widow Ganesse. It was the first time we had ever heard the name, Manny reports. There would be no classes that morning, Rumley announced. After breakfast, the boys were free to visit the farm, but should be back by noon. Thus, Manny writes, after breakfast we all trotted down the tracks, and when we reached the site, we were surprised to see all the things that had developed. There were uniformed men from the sheriff's office, including himself, and a couple of policemen from LaPorte. Firefighters were there from volunteer groups, aided by a water tank wagon from LaPorte's equipment. One shed building had been set aside for newspaper men, and already there were a half dozen or so of these from Michigan City, LaPorte, and South Bend. Others would soon arrive from Chicago, Indianapolis, and other places, for already word had gone out over the railroad telegraph keys telling of the fire and indicating that it was not an ordinary farm fire. All that remained of what was once a beautiful country home were three ghastly and blackened walls. As Manny watched, a corps of firemen under the direction of Chief Thomas Warwell, using ladders, ropes, and hooks, tore down the walls so that searchers could work in the ruins without worrying about falling bricks. By the time they were done, nothing was left but the cellar. A sort of open well, as Manny described it. With Smutzer leading the way, the searchers began digging through the cellar, while firemen did their best to cool off the still smoldering debris with bucketfuls of water. Following a brief mid-morning respite, when he went back home for breakfast, William Humphrey returned to the Ganesse place and joined in the digging. The work was conducted under great difficulties, one observer recorded, for the ruins were a hotbed of coals from which smoke and steam constantly poured. After hours of labor, however, the men had brought to light nothing but pieces of bedding, bedsteads, an old pistol, and articles of that kind. By mid-afternoon, after excavating nearly the entire cellar, they were becoming mystified, for they began to think that the bodies were not in the ruins. Only one area, the southeast corner, remained unexplored. William Humphrey was shoveling through the charred wreckage there at around 3:45 p.m. when, as he later put it, his shovel hit something soft. He called to Sheriff Smutzer, who was working nearby, and we commenced to dig carefully. Other men quickly gathered around them. A moment later, Humphrey paused and said, "Here they are." LaPorteans learned of this grisly development just a few hours after it happened, Harry Burr Darling having managed to insert a two-sentence bulletin into his page one story before his paper went to press. "The bodies of the mother and her children were found, piled up together," he announced, indicating that the mother had evidently made an effort to escape from the house with the children clinging to her. The following day, a far more extensive account dominated the front page. According to Darling, the condition of little Philip Ganesse, the youngest of the trio of little innocents and the least burned of the four bodies, told a heart-rending story of his mother's heroic but futile effort to save her offspring. The mother, aroused from her sleep by the crackling of the flames and the fumes of suffocating smoke, true to the maternal instinct, had thrown a quilt about the child, evidently with the idea of protecting its little body from the cold after they had gained the open. The quilt served to protect in a measure the body of the child. Catering to his reader's appetite for morbid titillation, Darling did not stint on the ghastly details in picturing the remains of the boy, whose face was black, with a hole in the forehead evidently from a falling brick. Its limbs below the knees had been burned away. The child's mouth was open, silent testimony to the agony of death. His description of Philip's two sisters was an equally shameless blend of mawkish sentimentality and rank sensationalism. The little girls who the night previous had breathed a tender prayer, lisping the words, "Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord my soul to keep," were but a semblance of human beings who a few hours previous lived in the smile of their master. Hideous as these blackened and dismembered bodies were, however, it was Mrs. Ganess who presented the most ghastly appearance. Her body was an unrecognizable mass, with the bones protruding through the naked flesh. Rendering her remains even more appalling was the absence of her head. Evidently, so Darling surmised, the corpse had been decapitated by the ruthless and torturing flames. "The diggers in the ruins have yet to find the skull," he reported, "for this would be all that remained of the missing head." The four corpses were carefully removed from the debris and placed on boards, where they remained until the town undertaker, Austin Cutler, arrived in his hack wagon. The bodies were then loaded on board and driven to the funeral home morgue. "Only one member of the doomed family had escaped the Holocaust," noted Harry Burr Darling, "Mrs. Ganess's stepdaughter, Jenny. Even at that moment the young woman was on her way from California to this city. She is expected to arrive here in a day or two, and it is thought that she will be able to throw some light on the mystery." 13. Arrest. Though initial reports claimed that he had disappeared, Ray Lamphere had, in fact, gone off to work at John Wheatbrook's farm that morning. He was still there when Deputies Leroy Marr and William Antis drove out in the late afternoon. About a mile from the farm, the road grew so muddy that Marr got out and walked the rest of the way. Just as he reached the front gate, Lamphere, who must have been watching through a window, opened the front door of the house. "Ray," said Marr, "get on your coat and come to town with me." If Marr had any doubts that the wiry little handyman had some involvement in the tragedy, they were dispelled by the first words out of Ray's mouth. "Did those three children and the woman get out of the building?" Asked how he knew about the fire, he told Marr that, after rising at 3 that morning, he'd set out on the 6-mile hike to John Wheatbrook's farm. As he passed near the Ganess farm, he'd seen smoke coming out of the windows and around the roof. "Why didn't you yell?" asked Marr. "I didn't think it was any of my business," said Ray. Brought to the county jail, Ray was subjected to the first of what would be a string of third-degree grillings, sweatings, as they were commonly called at the time. The interrogation was conducted by Sheriff Smutzer, Deputies Antis and Marr, and State's Attorney Ralph N. Smith, who had hurried to the jailhouse when he heard of Lamphere's arrest. Though Ray stuck to the essentials of his original story, he offered a different explanation for his failure to sound the alarm. "I was afraid I'd be blamed for starting the fire," he said. He also provided a detail he had omitted from his initial account, one that he begged his interrogators not to make public. He had spent the night of the fire in bed with Elizabeth Smith. The pervasive everyday racism of American culture in the early decades of the 20th century, an era of mammy songs, pickaninny jokes, and blackface vaudevillians, requires no documentation. It might also be noted that, within 20 years of the Ganess fire, Indiana would be home to the largest branch of the Ku Klux Klan in the nation, with a membership of 250,000, roughly one quarter of the native-born white male population of the state. It is not surprising, then, that in referring to Elizabeth Smith, the local newspapers routinely used the name by which she was known among her neighbors, Nigger Liz. The daughter of Virginia slaves who migrated to Indiana after the Civil War, Smith was said to have been a beauty in her youth, the handsomest black girl in Indiana. According to local rumor, she had won the hearts of many of the young men of the time, not all of whom had black faces. One of her reputed lovers was a brilliant LaPorte lawyer, with whom she bore an illegitimate half-white daughter. A half-century later, stories were still being told of the sensational climax of that affair, when the man gave her a note for $600 to educate their child, and then became converted at a revival, in which he arose and confessed his misdeeds. For thus publicly drawing attention to their affair, the Negro girl horsewhipped the lawyer on the public square before a great crowd, the man finally breaking away and finding refuge in a nearby drugstore. By the time of Ray Lamphere's arrest, no vestige of her former loveliness remained. With her bony frame, wrinkled face, tattered black shawl, and musty old Mother Hubbard dress, Smith, now in her 70s, cut a scarecrowish figure. Among neighborhood children, her ramshackle, refuse-crammed hovel was believed to be the habitation of a witch. Long into adulthood, many remembered running past her place as youngsters filled with terror. Her advanced age and physical deficiencies appeared to make no difference to Ray Lamphere, a man evidently blessed with highly flexible standards of female beauty. Cast out by his nearly 300-pound lover, Belle Ganess, he had found comfort in the bed of the spindle-shanked Elizabeth Smith. Visiting the jail on the morning following Ray's arrest, Smith spoke to a local reporter, confirming Lamphere's alibi, while discreetly omitting the more scandalous detail that the latter had confessed to officials the evening before. "That man Lamphere came to my house Monday night and asked for a room," she explained. "He said he was sick and had no money. 'If I ever get any money, I'll pay you,' he told me, and then he sat down a while. He fell asleep in the chair and slept about half an hour. Then he woke up and said, 'Are you going to let me have the room?' I told him I thought so, and he went over to Smith's saloon and got something to eat. I had my clock set for 4:30, and he turned it back to 3:30. I heard the alarm go off and went in to wake him up. He was snoring like a good fellow, and I told him it was after 4 o'clock. He said, 'My God, I ought to be over to Wheatbrook's by this time,' and started out. I didn't see him after he left my house until this morning. I can sure say, though, that he was at my house at 4 o'clock that morning." Smith's corroboration of Ray's whereabouts at the time of the fire did nothing to dispel the universal belief in his guilt. Newspapers throughout the Midwest did not hesitate to brand him a maniac, a homicidal firebug whose mad infatuation with Mrs. Ganess had driven him to set her house ablaze when she failed to reciprocate his passion. Rumor spread that Lamphere would fall victim to lynch law. "The feeling in LaPorte is running high, and mob violence is feared at any moment," reported the Cleveland Plain Dealer. "Police in large numbers are guarding the jail, and Lamphere has collapsed. The whole city is excited." At the inquest that evening, conducted by Coroner Charles Mack, 5 witnesses testified: Joe Maxson, Michael and William Clifford, William Humphrey, and Daniel Hudson. Attending the proceedings were State's Attorney Smith, Sheriff Smutzer, Deputies Antis and Marr, Clerk J. Roy Morrison, who transcribed the evidence, and a handful of newspaper men. Between them, the 5 witnesses offered a vivid account of the events of that fateful morning. Maxson, asked about the evening before the tragedy, stated that by the time he went to bed, the fire in the wood stove had died out, and that the kerosene lamps in the house were never left burning during the night. His evidence was important in bearing out the belief that an incendiary started the fire, one reporter noted. It was Daniel Hudson, however, who offered what the newspapermen deemed the most dramatic testimony of the inquest. Asked by Sheriff Smutzer about the discovery of the 4 bodies in the cellar, Hudson, who had been one of the men who had helped lift the corpses from the rubble, declared that "the whole head of Mrs. Ganess was gone from the neck back." Looking at what remained of her after she was placed on a board, he "could see her heart from where her head should be. I could look right on from her shoulders to the heart." At least, that's what he thought he was seeing. "She was burned so," Hudson said, "that I cannot say what it was." Repeated sweatings of Lamphere having failed to produce a confession, Sheriff Smuts resorted to another time-honored technique for trying to break down a suspect. Early Thursday morning, Ray was taken from his cell in handcuffs, escorted to Smutzer's jaunty little automobile, and told he was going for a ride. Unbeknownst to him, his destination was the morgue in the Cutler Funeral Home, where, as Harry Burr Darling would report in his typically overwrought way, he was to look upon all that was mortal of the woman he had hounded in life, and the three little innocents who, but a few days ago, played about the home which was even then fated to become their funeral pyre. Confronted with the hideously charred remains of Belle and her children, Lamphere trembled and paled. "My God!" he gasped. "Now, Lamphere," said Smutzer, "there is some of your work. What do you think of it?"
"Isn't that awful?" stammered Ray, who seemed on the brink of collapse.
Deeply shaken, he was hustled back out to Smutzer's car and driven directly to court for his arraignment. Before Justice Grover, State's Attorney Smith read aloud the affidavit, charging that on the 28th day of April 1908, one Ray Lamphere did then and there unlawfully and feloniously kill and murder one Belle Ganess in the perpetration of arson, and did then and there feloniously, willfully, and maliciously set fire to the house of the said Belle Ganess, and by reason and means of said burning by said Ray Lamphere, as aforesaid, said Belle Ganess was then and there mortally burned, and then and there died, contrary to the form of the statute in such case made and provided and against the peace and dignity of the state of Indiana. After pleading not guilty, Ray was ordered held without bond. He was then returned to his cell to await the action of the circuit court grand jury, scheduled to meet Monday, May 11th. In the meantime, a score of men continued to dig through the rubble in search of the dead woman's missing skull. "Where is the head of Belle Ganess?" ran a headline in the Chicago Tribune. According to Dr. Lucius Gray and other LaPorte physicians, no heat could have been severe enough to have wholly cremated the woman's skull. Failure to find it in the ruins of the cellar would therefore lend credence to a theory that many had come to believe in recent days, that Ray Lamphere wasn't merely an arsonist, but a fiendish killer who had stolen into Mrs. Ganess's room in the dark, decapitated her, and then set fire to the house to cover the evidence of his crime. 14. Siblings. Stories about the missing head continued to swirl. According to one, Mrs. Ganess had been murdered and decapitated for the gold in her teeth. Sheriff Smutzer, however, scoffed at this theory, arguing that no one would perpetrate such an atrocity for several hundred dollars worth of gold fillings, and besides, it would have been rather cumbersome for anybody to carry off a head. The post-mortem examination of Mrs. Ganess confirmed his opinion. A team of physicians, led by Dr. J. Lucius Gray, concluded that the head of Mrs. Ganess was not cut from the body before death. All agreed that it was burned off. They found no evidence of violence, nothing to indicate that death had been caused by anything other than suffocation and fire. The head was not the only missing part of the body. Though cast in cool, clinical terms, the final autopsy report vividly conveyed the sheer ghastliness of the woman's remains. Left arm burned off to the upper third of humerus, right arm burned off at the shoulder, right leg burned off at the knee, left foot burned off at ankle. All muscular tissue was thoroughly burned and charred. The entire right side of the torso, from chest to abdomen, had been burned away, leaving the internal organs completely exposed. The lungs, intestines, liver, and pancreas all appeared normal, the report noted, except cooked. On Friday, May 1st, the alleged perpetrator of the atrocity was reported to be seeking the consolation of religion. Summoning Dr. Edwin A. Shell, pastor of the LaPorte Methodist Church, to his cell, Ray Lamphere requested and received a copy of the Bible. On the front page of the following day's Argus Bulletin, editor Harry Burr Darling interpreted the prisoner's sudden interest in Scripture as a sign that he might be on the brink of confessing, that, as Burr put it in his typically turgid way, Lamphere wanted to read the sacred word, hoping that he might find therein some message of the Master which would cause a penitent heart to unfold a tale. Among the passengers who arrived by train from Chicago that same Friday morning was a stout, white-haired matron with wire-framed granny glasses who looked to be in her 70s, although her actual age was 54. This was Mrs. Nellie Larson. 8 years had passed since she had last seen her younger sister, then known as Bella Sorensen.
It had come as a dreadful shock to her when, while reading Wednesday's newspaper, she found herself looking at a photograph of her estranged sibling and learned of the inferno in which Bella and her three children had died. Her dismay was compounded when a subsequent article reported that, according to the provisions of the will Bella had made one day before the fire, her entire estate, estimated to be worth $15,000, would go to the Norwegian Children's Home of Chicago. Accompanied by her adult children, John R. Larson and Mrs. Edward Howard, Nellie had hastened to La Porte. Alighting from the train, the trio proceeded directly to the Cutler morgue. Unable to bring herself to view the awful remains, Mrs. Larson consigned that solemn duty to her son. Afterward, the three conferred with Undertaker Cutler about arrangements to transport the bodies to Chicago, where, in accordance with Belle's final wishes, they would be laid to rest in the Forest Home Cemetery. Their next stop was the office of Belle's attorney, Melvin Lelider. There, Mrs. Larson and her children made it known that they intended to contest Belle's will and, as the closest living relatives of the deceased, claim their share of the estate. Another interested party who had read of the tragedy in the papers arrived by train that morning. Jenny Olson's older sister, Mrs. George Olander of 2818 South Park Avenue, Chicago. Though separated since childhood, when Jenny was given over to Belle's care, the sisters had kept up a regular correspondence. Mrs. Olander, however, had not heard from the younger woman in 2 years, when Jenny wrote to say that she was being sent to a Norwegian seminary in California. Mrs. Olander had made efforts to discover the exact name and location of the school, but without success. Like Nellie Larson, Mrs. Olander had hurried to La Porte after reading accounts of the tragedy in the Chicago papers. Stories had begun to circulate that Jenny had gotten married in California and was on her wedding tour. "She is now supposed to be on her way to the city with her husband," the Argus Bulletin reported, "and is doubtful in ignorance of the tragic fate of the woman who guided her steps in childhood." Mrs. Olander was worried, however, that Jenny might have reached home the day before the fire and met the same awful death as her foster mother and siblings. There was something else troubling Mrs. Olander. She, too, had read the newspaper stories about Mrs. Ganesh's will. She could not understand why Belle had bequeathed everything to Myrtle, Lucy, and Philip, or, in the event of their deaths, to the orphanage in Chicago, and left nothing at all to Jenny. In his efforts to locate his missing brother, Ossola Helgeline had communicated not only with Belle Ganess, but with La Porte Police Chief Clinton Cochran, who confirmed that a man matching Andrew's description had been seen in the city. After learning that Andrew had arranged to have his savings wired to the First National Bank of La Porte, Ossola also sent a query, along with a photograph of his brother, to Frank J. Pittner, the clerk who had handled the transaction. Pittner promptly wrote back to say that Andrew was without doubt the man who had come to the bank with Belle Ganess to cash in his certificates of deposit. On May 1st, the same day that Mrs. Larson, her two children, and Mrs. Olander all arrived in La Porte, Ossola received an envelope from Pittner. Inside was the front page of the La Porte Daily Herald of April 28th, reporting on the fiery destruction of the Ganess house and the death of its occupants. The following day, Ossola Helgeline was on his way to La Porte. 15. Horror. He arrived late Sunday, May 3rd, and stayed overnight at the Hotel Tea Garden. Early the next day, he made his way to the office of the La Porte Herald, purchased back issues of all the daily papers from the date of the fire on, and spent the next hour or so poring over them. He then proceeded to the sheriff's office and introduced him to Al Smutzer, who listened to his tale, then drove him out to the Ganess farm. By then, only two men were still engaged in digging through the rubble, Belle's hired hand, Joe Maxson, and her neighbor, Daniel Hudson. Hoping to find some clue to his brother's fate, Ossola joined in the work, while Maxson and Hudson kept an eye out for Mrs. Ganess's still-missing head. The cellar yielded nothing but charred household debris. That night, Ossola accepted the hospitality of Belle's neighbors, the Swan Nicholson family, who were happy to open their home to a fellow Norwegian. When he returned to the Ganess farm early the next day, Maxson and Hudson were already at work, shoveling through the ruins of the cellar. Ossola spent some time hiking around the property, searching for anything suspicious. Seeing the big lake nearby, he returned to the two diggers and, as he later testified, Ask some questions, whether there were any holes in the ice on the lake in the winter, how deep the water was. If his brother had met with foul play, Fish Trap Lake would have been a handy place to dispose of the body. But as far as Maxon and Hudson recalled, the lake had been a solid sheet of ice all winter. It seemed to Arcelor that there was no point in hanging around the Ganesh place any longer. He would have to look elsewhere for some trace of Andrew. "I told the boys goodbye," he recalled afterward, "and I started down to the road." He hadn't gone far, however, when he stopped and swiveled on his heels. "I was not satisfied," he would explain, "and I went back to the cellar and asked Maxon whether he knew of any hole or dirt having been dug up there about the place in spring." As a matter of fact, Maxon did. Sometime back in March, he couldn't remember the exact date, he had helped Mrs. Ganesh load up a wheelbarrow with old cans, shoes, and other rubbish, then hauled it to a pit that had been dug in a fenced-off portion of the barnyard used as a hog lot, about 50 feet south of the house. At his employer's direction, he had then dumped in the refuse and filled in the hole. Arcelor asked Maxon to show him the spot, and the three men, shovels in hand, headed for the yard and began to dig. It wasn't long before their nostrils were assaulted with an awful bad smell. "Mr. Maxon told me that Mrs. Ganesh had put a lot of tomato cans and fish cans there. Maybe it was they made it stink," Arcelor would say. But the feeder that arose from the pit smelled nothing like rotting tomatoes and fish. Their shovels struck the source of the stench about 4 feet down. Something hard, covered with a gunny sack. There was a tear in the fabric. Through it, they could see a human neck. In the dirt beside the sack lay a man's severed arm. Within minutes, Maxon was at the reins of Mrs. Ganesh's buggy and racing to town. Looking around the yard, Arcelor found an old coat and a few gunny sacks, and laid them over the grisly find. Then he and Hudson picked up their shovels and carefully cleared away more of the dirt from the fetid grave. They had just finished when Sheriff Smutzer drove up. Beside him was Coroner Charles S. Mack, an imposing white-bearded fellow, garbed in a rumpled three-piece suit, with a wing-collared shirt, black bow tie, and fob chain strung across his vest. Under Mack's watchful eye, Smutzer and the others soon brought the rotted body parts to the surface. Coroner Mack would later depose that it was impossible to provide a particular and minute description of the corpse, owing to the fact that the head was separate from the torso, as was each arm from the shoulder down, and each leg from about 3 inches above the knee down, and to the further fact that putrefaction had set in. The face, moreover, or what remained of it, was, in the words of one chronicler, a thing of horror. Sunken holes for eyes, a leering gash for a mouth, a zigzag crack running from the top of the skull to the forehead. Certain deductions could be drawn from the putrid remains, despite their appalling condition. It seemed clear, for example, that the victim had fought for his life. Across his left wrist, as if he had lifted it to ward off a slashing blow, were two deep cuts laying it open to the bone. Another savage blow had chopped off the first joints of every finger of his right hand. In a death grip, the mutilated hand held a tuft of short brown curly hair, torn from the head of his murderer. The ghastly face, though resembling a Halloween horror mask more than anything human, also retained enough of its features to make an identification possible. "I recognize it by the form of the face, across the eye, the forehead, across the cheeks," Arcelor Helgelein would later testify. "When you have been with your brother every day for 15 years, you know him." Arcelor's long search for his brother Andrew had come to an end in a trash pit in Belle Ganesh's barnyard. A drizzling rain had begun to fall. As Coroner Max squatted on his haunches for a nearer look at the unearthed remains, Sheriff Smutzer asked Joe Maxon if he knew of any other soft spots on the property, places where holes had been dug, then loosely covered over with dirt. Maxon pointed to a spot a short distance away. By then a small crowd of curiosity seekers had gathered at the farm. As they pressed their faces to the wire mesh fence, Maxon, Hudson, and Smutzer began to dig. 3 feet down beneath a pile of rubbish, they uncovered a jumble of putrefied body parts.
naked torsos wrapped in burlap, heads, arms, and legs scattered around. The buggy shed was turned into a makeshift morgue for the hideous trove. There were four victims in all, two men, one woman, one female adolescent, each divided into six pieces. As with Andrew Helgeline's corpse, few firm conclusions could be drawn from the disposition.